history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you. There are men and women in our midst that we really don't know what they've done for the sake of our country unless we take the time to ask them and listen to their stories. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And today, we're going to meet a young Marine. Well, he's 90 years young these days, and we're going to go back a lot further than that with Glenn Bram of Gilroy, California. And I know they say once a Marine, always a Marine, but I guess once from Gilroy, always from Gilroy for you.
Yep, that's right. I was born here.
Did they call it the garlic capital of the world then?
Yep. No, that came later.
How big a difference is there? I know there's the big garlic festival here every year, and the city has grown. Can you contrast what it was like when you were a kid compared to Gilroy now?
Oh, when I was a kid, I can remember when there was 1,500 people in Gilroy. Now there's over 50,000.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when we went to school, there was the high school was probably 100, I guess. But Gilroy's grown a lot. I don't know, my dad was on the police department here in the early 1940s, 38 and 40. And he was on there for 4 years. And him and one other cop were on at night, and they were only two that were on. When one of them took his night off, the other one was on by himself, and that was it. There wasn't much going on.
Yep, that does put it in perspective. When you only have two cops, I guess it's not that big a town, and I guess you couldn't get into any trouble if your dad was one of the two.
No.
But you grew up on the Pacheco Pass, and anyone who's come through this part of California has made that drive. A lot of times it's pretty golden and dry, but right now it's gorgeous. Man, what a beautiful drive I had over the pass today.
It is beautiful this year, yep.
With the wildflowers and rolling green hills and the little creeks and, of course, the big reservoir that wasn't there when you were growing up.
No.
What was your childhood like? Were you out chasing game in the hills and doing stuff like that?
Fishing and hunting. I was born and raised with that. We had a cattle ranch and had deer hunting. So I was hunting all the time, and right here in Gilroy, I could go out and shoot jackrabbits just where I'm living right now. Why it was just all hay fields and fishing. Why we caught steelhead in the creek. And once they put the dam in, the Uvas Dam, why it stopped that. They couldn't get up. And the steelhead do come up, but not as many. But that was something we did. I'd take my bicycle and ride out to the Uvas Creek and catch my limit of fish and come home.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the hunting. Now, I read a description of you in a book that someone wrote about Saipan where it heaped high praise on your aim and your eye as a sharpshooter. Was that honed in those youth years here in Gilroy?
Probably, because when I went in the Marines, I was only 17.
Mm-hmm.
And so on the rifle range, we shot a practice round before the day shooting for record. And the perfect score was 340, and I shot 338 that day. And so all these officers says, oh, this kid's going to break the record tomorrow. Well, a little wind came up, and it threw it off a little bit, but I still shot 326. And there were 65 in our platoon, and I won $1 from each one of them, so I won $65. And they wanted me to stay and be an instructor. But you had to be 19 years old, so I couldn't do that. So.
Uh-huh. I could see how that would develop a reputation for you. Yeah. And as I sit here looking at you, you're under a couple of bucks that you shot decades ago and a lamp next to you made out of antlers. And I guess the proof is in the pudding here.
Yeah.
Was that something that you always thought about, getting in the service someday? Or did that come about because
right
of
after
the war?
Right after the war. See, the war in December, a lot of my friends joined right away. Well, I graduated from high school in June of 42, but I was only 16 when I graduated.
Wow.
I tried to get in then, and they said, no. I went to San Francisco, and the tried to get in the Marines. They said, well, we'll call you when we think you're old enough. So they called in February of 43 and asked if I was still interested. And I said, yeah. So they said, we'll come up right away. So I went up and they said, how long do you need to settle all your affairs before you leave? And I said, I don't have anything to settle. They said, well, come up tomorrow and you're on your way. So I went up and took the physical, and then I went. So that was pretty fast.
I guess so. And I've got to ask you, I'm sorry to bounce around, and we're going to hear about all the battles you were in, Tarawa and Saipan and Tinian and Okinawa. But about December 7th, you mentioned that you wanted to sign up right afterwards, but what do you remember about that day specifically and how you got the news?
That day I was duck hunting. Uh-huh. We were coming back from Las Panas.
Hey, hey, my hometown.
And left a friend of ours off at Bell Station. He worked for the state highway, and they had the state yard there before, just past Bell Station. So we left him off, and his wife told us about it. So that's the first I knew about it. But
did your eyes get as big as saucers?
Yeah.
Did that blow your mind a little bit?
Oh, yeah. And a lot of the Japanese, I went to school with so many of them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still friends with a lot of them. I play golf with them, but they shipped them all out. No, we were sure surprised.
What was that like to see these guys that you'd gone to school with, played sports with, been friends with, and all of a sudden they're enemy aliens?
I didn't think it was right, really, because the ones that were left with me, I trusted them. I mean, I knew it wasn't their fault.
Mm-hmm.
That's why when I came home, guys says, how can you play golf with some of the guys that were shooting at you? And I said, well, they weren't the ones. So.
But there were guys shooting at you, and we're going to hear that. And what about the Marines attracted you? Why did you want to be one of those guys?
I don't know. I just because of shooting. Well, I didn't want to get in the Navy because I couldn't swim.
Ah.
Didn't want to get in the Air Corps because I was afraid of heights. So I thought the Marines would be the one. So.
Little did you know what you were getting into. So you told us about your marksmanship that was evident early on. Was there kind of a welcome to the Marine Corps moment for you that really kind of christened you, or a trial by fire, baptism by fire kind of moment?
When I first got in, I realized when we went into boot camp, we went in, guys that were already there for a few weeks, says, you'll be sorry. Well, I knew right away what they were talking about. After a couple of weeks, I wondered, what am I doing here? Because they gave you a lot of crap and,
uh-huh.
and made you like it. But the boot camp training was fast. At that time, I forget, it was only a couple of months, I guess. We moved through pretty fast.
Yeah. Well, they had to get you over there for those battles. You told me you had a brother. Did he end up in the war also?
Later on, he went in the Air Corps. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you're in the Marine Corps. You do all this training. And at what point did you start to get familiar with the BAR, the Browning Automatic Rifle? Because I read that that was one of your duties.
Yeah, well, after I got overseas, but I shot it in boot camp. We had the M1, the Garand, we shot that, and then we shot the BAR. But I liked the BAR. It was good. And once I got over there, I got a hold of it. They gave me one. Even afterwards, when I became a squad leader later, I just had a carbine.
Mm-hmm.
But if there was a chance to pick up a BAR, I did it. I mean, you could always find one because I liked them.
And what about this nickname? Who started calling you Pluto? Where in the world did that come from?
After the war, the campaign was over, they brought in movies, and they said I laughed like Pluto, the way I laughed. So somebody said that, and then they just gave me that. In fact, there was, at the same time, they'd congratulate somebody on their birthday or something at the movie, and this one night, the guy says, oh, I want to congratulate Pluto Brem. He's the proud father of twins. Pluto's been over here for 18 months. And all these officers laughed. Well, here I've been over there 18 months, and he's the proud father of twins.
Right.
So,
how do you pull that off?
Yeah.
And I'm sure your wife Muriel would be very interested
to hear about that.
Speaking of, did you meet her before you went overseas?
We went to high school together, yeah.
Uh-huh. So before you went overseas, did you have any inkling that this one might be your wife someday?
No. We went out a couple of times, but that was about it. We wrote a couple of letters, and then when I got home on the furlough, I was home 2 or 3 weeks and finally ran into her, and we dated a couple of times. Then I went back to duty and then came home on another furlough for 30 days. Finally, I got discharged in October. We had gone together probably from June to October, and when I got discharged, we decided we'd get married, so we got married in December.
Mm-hmm.
Both young. I was 20 and she was 19.
But I guess it worked.
Yeah.
70 years later, you can talk about you had five children together, you have 15 grandkids, 32 great-grandkids. I guess it worked out all right. Yeah. I guess it's really good that you made it home from the war, and we're going to hear how many odds you beat to do that. Tell me about this first one, and a lot of people don't know about this battle. If they were alive then, they did, because it turned into a documentary film that actually won an Oscar with the Marines at Tarawa. Tarawa, as some might
say. Yeah, we called it Tarawa,
But yeah, you can hear it 10 different ways, but you were there, and you know how bloody it was. Yeah. How did you experience that battle over a tiny little strip of land?
Well, it was tough. The landing, there was, when you got on the beach, we had about a one-foot foothold on there, because you couldn't, we were right up against a little barrier, and you couldn't stick your head up because they'd peck at you. And the waves that came in later were getting more punishment than we took. Some of them got dumped into 10 or 15 feet of water, too. The boats didn't come in far enough. The second day was worse, but finally we got them straightened out a little bit where they could get in. But in fact, I think they said that after the first day, they didn't think they were going to send any more in, but they did. But it took 4 days, and the island was only a couple of miles long and, I don't know, 3/4 of a mile wide at the widest spot. But it was fast, and they had pillboxes that were, I don't know, 6 or 7 stories deep. And that's why they bombed them for weeks and thought they had everything cleaned out. But they were just like squirrels that go down, and after the shelling was over, they'd come back up again.
And I'm just imagining you and how ill-prepared you must have been as a teenager who's never been in combat before, and this is what you're up against.
Yeah.
How did you handle that? Were you scared? I mean, did you think you were going to survive it?
Well, you just wonder when you were going to get hit, I guess. But, I mean, sure, you were scared, and you prayed a little bit. Like they said, that there's no atheist in the foxhole. But anyway, when you're young, the older you get, the more you really think about it. Then after we were only on there 4 days, and then that was over, then we came home and went to Hawaii then.
Well, you probably needed to recover from what you endured there and what you saw. And you said, you know, you're waiting to get hit. Well, while you're waiting, you're seeing other guys get hit.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What was that like? And I'm sure some of these guys are guys, if you didn't know them, you'd been around them, you'd seen them.
Yeah.
What was that like? And can you give us a sense of what you witnessed there and how hard it was?
I don't know how to explain it. I mean, you see something like that, and you can't believe it, really, when you see a guy get blown up, some of them getting hit in the head. It's tough to even think about.
Did you have any contact with your family during this time?
No, later on, once in a while, I'd get a letter about every few months, but no, I didn't talk to my family. Well, it was 30 months before I even came home.
Yeah. So you survive Tarawa.
Yeah.
And you get to Hawaii.
We were in Hilo for about 6 months. That was just recuperating and then started training for the next operation.
During that time, as you left Tarawa, and maybe during your time in Hawaii, was there a point at which you grasped the magnitude of that battle that you had been in, or the magnitude of the losses there by your division?
Yeah, you're just wondering if you were lucky, figured you were lucky to get through it, and wondered what was coming next. You knew there was going to be another one, and you wondered if you're going to get through that one. So, you know, each one, the law of averages kind of gets to you.
And Glenn spent a lot of time defying those odds until becoming a Purple Heart recipient himself. We're going to hear about that before we're done. And we also have a video up on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page with Glenn showing you where he got hit. So much of the story is where he didn't get hit and why a jammed rifle may have saved his life. As for Tarawa, in November of 1943, that four-day battle over 1 square mile of hell, as an acclaimed book put it, claimed over 6,000 lives if you add up both sides. More than 1,000 American Marines were killed, more than 2,000 more wounded, and nearly 700 sailors were killed when the Japanese sank the escort carrier USS Liscombe Bay. One of our upcoming episodes will feature a man who witnessed that sinking, but when we come back with 90-year-old Glenn Brehm, we'll follow him to Saipan, Tinian, and eventually Okinawa. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.